United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined by my colleagues this afternoon, Judge Falvey and Judge Jakereth. We're convened via video conference to hear arguments in the matter of Lewis Francis against Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 20-5236. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Robert C. Brown, Jr. for appellant Lewis Francis.
Tommy D. Clever, Jr.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honors. Brent Boker for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and I'm joined by Ken Walsh for the Secretary.
Welcome. I understand, Mr. Brown, that you want to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, the clock is set up for that, and you can begin whenever you're ready. You're muted, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Robert Brown, and I represent Lewis R. Francis, the appellate. Mr. Francis appeals the amount of disability assigned for his service-connected headaches for the periods September 24, 2009 to February 10, 2010 and February 11, 2010 to November 2014. The reason he is appealing these is he believes that he should be entitled to the 50% rating for the entire period on appeal. Mr. Francis has disclaimed any prior entitlement prior to September 24, 2009, and he did that on the record during his hearing before the board in the record at pages 55 and 56. The thrust of the appeal has three points. First of all, we pleaded an error of law, an error of fact, and a combined error of fact and law with regard to reasons and basis. I start with the fact error because it's the easiest way to dispense with the claim. In this case, there's testimony in the record about the frequency and prostrating nature of Mr. Francis's headaches. And that's found in the testimony from both the veteran and his wife during the board's hearing at pages 50 and 51 of the record. Even though there's testimony, the board's decision held that the evidence does not show his headaches were productive of prostrating attacks. So we cited to Buchanan versus Nicholson to talk about credibility, and we cited to Gilbert versus Derwinski to talk about the clearly erroneous standard. So in this case, the first point is the board finding that there's no evidence when there is testimony in the record without a proper explanation.
And Mr. Brown, can I interrupt you? So even if we accepted your point that you're making now, which you've characterized as a error of fact or perhaps the reasons and bases, we need to reach your legal issue because we can't avoid it, meaning you've raised a point that says as a matter of law, the board member who decides the appeal must be the same board member who conducted a hearing, which would mean if that board member isn't there, then we have to have a new hearing. So if it's possible, if you could turn to that question, which I'm assuming is your question of law.
Your Honor, in the brief, the opening brief of the case, we explained that this amounts to an agency overreach in switching the judge in between having the hearing held and having the decision being being written. And we looked at the statute itself, 38 United States Code, Section 7102, and I quoted it directly in the brief. And the quote is that a member or panel assigned a proceeding shall make a determination thereon, including any motion filed in connection therewith. The member or panel, as the case may be, shall make a report under Section 7104D of this title on any such determination. And I pointed out, especially in the reply, that the writing of Section 7102, which has that strong language, was the same writing before the enactment of the AMA and after the enactment of the AMA.
And on that point, though, Mr. Brown, our court issued the decision in Arneson under the legacy system and seemed to, in that case, it was having to do with whether all three members of a three board member panel needed to be at a hearing. But basically, the court focused on what was then 7107 to decide that case. So the point you just made that I'm struggling with is that Arneson did not seem to place reliance on the language you're pointing to in 7102 on this question of whether or not the same member who conducts a hearing must be the one that renders the decision. So in fact, don't we have to give some weight, not weight, we have to do something with the fact that Congress removed from the statutes, Title 38, the very provision that Arneson relied on to reach its conclusion that as a matter of statutory interpretation, a board member has to conduct a hearing and then render the decision.
Your Honor, I appreciated the court's recent order instructing us to take a closer look at Arneson and Smith. And I did so. And I saw, first of all, that, of course, Arneson's a legacy case, as you said, and that Mr. Francis' case is being handled as an AMA case. However, one of the things I went to directly was I looked at the appellee brief, and at page 9, the appellee brief specifically says, I wrote it down here, and I quote from page 9, however, under the general rules for board hearings, which apply to AMA appeals, there is no requirement that the VLJ who conducts the hearing also decides the claim. And then it cites the regulation 38 CFR sections 20.700 to 20.715. And I also looked at section 20.801, which is the section about decisions. And in fact, there's no regulation or rule either way that says it must be conducted by the same judge or it can be conducted by a different judge. So I didn't find any authority in the new law that said that they're also allowed to change judges. And so my thought with that, since the previous authority directed them to keep the same judge and the new authority is quiet on that specific issue, that Arneson should stand as the law, because Arneson also talks about this issue of fair practice.
Yes. Now, before we get to fair process, right, help me with little baby steps, right? So yes, if the rule is that the same board member who conducts a hearing must render a decision, okay, if that's the rule of law that we're going to try to impose, then what I need to do is I need to be able to point to something that says that's the rule, okay? So fair process is a possibility. I'm going to put that aside for a second. Right now, I want to get back to Arneson's logic, right? Arneson's logic, although it says a lot about fair process, it fundamentally held that under 7107, as it existed in the legacy system, there was a requirement for the board member who conducted a hearing to to render the decision, or actually the flip, that the person who rendered the decision had to be at the hearing, okay? Congress took out that language from 7107. So what I'm trying to get is, what import does the removal of that language from 7107 have as to the statutory basis on which a hearing is, or on which that rule exists? That is, that the person who renders the decision had to have conducted the hearing. Because you correctly pointed out that 7102 didn't change, which meant 7102 existed as it did at the time of Arneson and does today. But the court didn't rely on 7102 to make its decision. It relied on 7107. Do you see what my question is on the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And with regard to that, I appreciate the question, because when I looked at Section 7107, the new version doesn't say that the board's allowed to switch judges. It really took out that section that made it mandatory that the same judge that conducted the hearing write the opinion. However, the other changes were really more about the allowing the board to use other forms of hearing, which really kind of implemented right about the same time, and we were lucky that it did. It implemented at the same time that the COVID happened, so we were able to do virtual hearings, and that really opened up the ability to do virtual hearings. But I didn't see anything in 7107 that said that they could switch judges when I read it.
I think I approach it slightly differently, which is, and maybe I'm wrong, and you can convince me I'm wrong, but I don't think Congress has to say you can't do this, right? Because I think the way Arneson was set up is Arneson said, Congress has mandated that a person who decides the case, the board member who decides the case, must have done the hearing. That was a rule. Maybe that rule was required in the absence of the statute. Maybe it wasn't. That's the fair process point. But Arneson said the statute requires it. Congress then in the AMA takes that language out of 7107. So maybe the answer is, even though Congress took it out, it didn't change what the law was. But is your best answer about whether there is something in a statute that mandates that the same board member who did the hearing do the decision, your 7102 point?
Yes, Your Honor. And I looked at the mandatory wording, and that's the quote that I read a moment ago, that a member or panel assigned a proceeding shall make a determination thereon. And I'm looking at the word proceeding. The proceeding was the hearing. So under 7102, the decision shall be made by the proceeding judge.
Mr. Brown, hi, this is Judge Falvey. Does your reading of 7102 then require us to in essence say that proceeding is the same as hearing, and not something, and not proceeding is something larger that includes perhaps a sub part of the proceeding, the hearing? Are you reading proceeding and hearing to be synonymous? I guess is a short way of saying that.
I guess, Your Honor, I'm speaking off the cuff on that word. But proceeding would include the hearing.
Does it include more than the hearing, such that the proceeding from the time the matter is appears at the board until the board makes a final board decision might include various components: review of the record, review of the submissions by the appellant, a hearing, drafting of a decision, etc. The final determination, which is going to result in an appealable decision, must be by the assigned member or panel.
That was my understanding of it when I first assessed the case, when I first met with the veteran and went through the issues with him, when I counseled him on how to proceed. One of the important things, Your Honor, in this case is to look at the procedural posture. This isn't really a true AMA case in that it's a ramp case. And so some of these events in his case took place before the implementation of the Appeals Modernization Act. And this veteran might not have known that a judge would be switched. So I look back at the history of the process before the implementation of the AMA.
Let me ask a follow-up there then. If a hearing is part of proceeding, but not all, does that change your argument at all that the hearing officer needs to be the same person that makes the determination and prepares the report?
Your Honor, that's my argument, and I'm going to stick with it. I understand that I might have a kind of a naive understanding of the word proceeding, but that was my understanding of proceeding, was that the way that the statute was written, the intent that I see there is that the judge assigned to the proceeding, and I took that to mean the hearing and greeting with the veteran and going through the issues with the veteran. Right. That's where that, because proceeding is followed by shall. It's the next word in the paragraph, in the sentence. So my understanding when I read that, because it's a very short statute, when I read that statute was that the member assigned to the proceeding shall make the determination thereon. And so handing it off to another board member after the hearing was held, I think that was wrong. I think that the way that this very short statute is written indicates that the person who is assigned to the proceeding shall make the determination.
Okay.
So, yes,
thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So moving on, after I talked about the fact issue, I talked about the law issue, and of course, I've talked now about the statute, the way it's written, the fact that it didn't change with the enactment of the AMA, that it's the same statute, although I do qualify that by understanding that Section 7107 did change, but as I've already said, 7107 did not provide authority to switch judges. And when I read, of course, the appellee brief, I saw once again that even their citation to authority doesn't show that there's authority for the board to switch judges. That the only authority there is that there's no requirement that they keep judges.
What if it's kind of a legal maxim, I think, that which is not prohibited is permitted. And 7107 used to prohibit or require someone stepping in midstream, substitution of judges, and it had to be the same one who conducted the hearing, had to make the determination. So it was prohibited. They eliminated that prohibition. Absent some other prohibition, this kind of goes back to Judge Allen's initial line of questioning, absent that prohibition in 7107, are you only relying on 7102 and your fair process argument to dictate the same result as Aronson did?
Your Honor, I also point to the fact that when Congress did write the new law, it didn't change Section 7102.
Well, true, but there's a rule of statutory interpretation that says if even though a provision does not change to other provisions may actually change the meaning of the initial statute or the unchanged statute. So, you know, the secretary may say something along the lines of, it didn't change, and it means the same thing it meant then, which it doesn't speak to the question of the identity of the hearing officer or requirement that the hearing officer be the same as the determination officer or judge. Or they may say that meaning changed with the change of 7107. The meaning of 7102 changed along with it. How do you respond to those arguments?
Your Honor, I looked at the change in 7107 specifically, and it looked like what Congress zeroed in on was about venue, not about the who presides. And so there was no focus on who presides, I didn't read there to be a change there other than the fact that it was absent. So the focus in the new version of 7107 is about venue and the methods with which the hearing can be conducted. So I don't think Congress spoke about who's presiding over the hearing at all. And the fact that they didn't change 7102, I still read that proceeding followed by the word shall as indicating to me that the presiding judge from the board from the outset shall make the determination because of the way that specific sentence is written. And I only looked at 7107 to see that there was no specific language there that said that the board is free to assign additional members as they see fit to change the person that makes the decision. And since that wasn't there, I look back, like I said, to 7102. And that's why I focused my entire reply on that specific issue, the fact that that statute remained the same and that when 7107 changed, it was only for the purpose of adding these additional venues and methods.
So, Mr. Brown, this is Judge Jaquith. You say the plain language of 7102 controls, and the secretary says the revision of section 7107 does. What should happen if the outcome of that tussle is inconclusive?
Well, Your Honor, as we were speaking before, Judge Allen asked me to wait, but with regard to the cases, the Arneson case, which was cited by the secretary in their brief, and then the court has also assigned us to look at the Smith case. They both cite to a case called Thurber versus Brown. And in the Arneson case, it specifically says the entire thrust of the VA's non-adversarial claim system is predicated on a structure which provides for notice and an opportunity to be heard at virtually every step in the process. So if we go back to Arneson, Arneson was a case specifically about adding a judge. It wasn't even about switching judges. It was about adding a judge. And in that case, the court used this issue of fair practice to provide the veteran with one opportunity to have this hearing in front of that judge. And the absence of a outright change in the law, I think, makes the precedent from Arneson and Smith, it makes them still the law. They remain the law because the precedent.
Mr. Brown, can I have two questions. One is a follow on to Judge Jaquith's question, and maybe I misunderstood what Judge Jaquith was getting at. Before you jump to fair process, and don't worry about the time, we asked you to address it and we've taken you on the first step, right? Because in my view, we don't get the fair process if the statute provides an answer, okay? So I had understood Judge Jaquith's question to be something along this line, and Judge Jaquith, correct me if I'm wrong. If we find some tension in the argument that you say the plain language of 7102 essentially reaches the same result that Arneson reached looking at 7107, okay? But the secretary says, no, really what's important here is the removal of the language from 7107. If we find tension there, should we look to the doctrine of Brown versus Gardner to say that statutory ambiguities, if that is what this is, would go in your favor? I had understood Judge Jaquith to be saying in the terms of the statute, we'll get to fair process. Is there something else we do in the statute before we throw up our hands and look to fair process?
That was indeed my intended follow-up, Judge Allen. Thank you.
Thank you both, gentlemen. I made a note to myself to read section 20.700 through 20.715, which are the new writings of the regulations to implement the changes in the law. And there's nowhere there where it says that the board can change judges. And then I went to section 20.801, and there's nowhere there where it says that they can change judges. And
let's forget about the VA for a second. Okay. No offense, Mr. Bowker. Here's what I mean. We're talking about regulations. I will stipulate that there's nothing that says they can or can't. Let's just assume that's part of my question. We don't have to get to the regulation if we can answer the question based on the statutes. So, are you disclaiming any reliance today on the interpretive canon of Brown versus Gardner? Or are you saying that that should have some role here?
Your Honor, I actually printed Brown versus Gardner, just in case you asked a question about it.
Not there.
Okay.
Well, looking at the case won't help you, I think. Just start with the, forget about the name. Assume that there is a canon of interpretation that says if a statute that benefits veterans is ambiguous, at some point in the interpretive process, a court will essentially say, we will interpret the statute with an eye towards the interpretation that is most favorable for veterans, okay? Are you asking us to employ that canon of construction at any point in our analysis in this case?
Well, yes, Your Honor, of course. I think in my mind that goes unsaid. So I just automatically believe you will.
Okay. So then how, right? So is it normally one thinks of that as saying you read a word and the word is ambiguous, and I'll adopt the interpretation of that word that is most favorable to veterans, okay? It's more complicated than that. And Dawn, you can add another 10 minutes, please, so we can discuss this. Here it's a little different than the normal situation because 7102 existed at the time of Arneson. Arneson relied on language that was pretty clear in 7107. Congress then removes that language. So there has to be some import to that, but doesn't touch 7102. And so what I'm wondering is, in that context, does Brown versus Gardner play any role in how we interpret either what Congress did to 7107 or what Congress didn't do to 7102?
I look at the... In Arneson, there's a concurring opinion from Judge Castle. And in that opinion, he takes the statutory approach instead of using fair process. And
stop right there. Arneson itself talks a lot about fair process, but its decision is not based on fair process, as I read it. Its decision is based on 7107. That's critical. That's critical. Because if Arneson were based, if your argument to us today is Arneson reached its results because of the fair process doctrine, then I think arguably our panel is bound, right? because the fair process doctrine is not a statutory one. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it's not a statute. Okay? So just work with me under my assumption that Arnes in itself also focused on the statute, right? What we're trying to do is figure out that what Arneson said was the statutory reason why the same board member had to do both things has been removed by Congress. So what I'm trying to get at is that removal something that we can say under Brown versus Gardner, we can ignore, has no meaning because we can interpret 7102 to be in your favor? Because I will tell you, I'm going to tip my hand, that seems like a strange reading of the canon of construction that would allow us to ignore what Congress actually did by removing language from 7107.
Your Honor, I'm looking at the actual holding in Arneson, and it does say exactly what you said. And it says, we hold the pertinent statutes and implementing regulation regarding board hearings entitled the claimant to an opportunity for a hearing before all board members who will ultimately decide his appeal. And so it does say that Arneson is based on the legal scheme that was in place at the time that Arneson was decided. And so I agree that that's what it says. But Arneson also found that from that, the claimant has a right to be afforded the opportunity to be heard by those assigned to adjudicate his appeal. And in this case, if we go back to the statutes and the regulations, which is where Arneson leads us, I still go back to the fact that 7102's language did not change. And 7107's language that did change was specifically pointed in a different direction. And it doesn't approach this issue. It approaches the venue and the process to allow for essentially the video hearings to be conducted virtually. So I think that when they did that, when they changed the language of 7107, if you look at the fact that it was actually pointed in a different direction and that 7102 didn't change, 7102 stayed the same, that in that respect, there isn't a change about the member assigned, because the member who was assigned, or at least the first member who was assigned, didn't make a determination. And it says the member assigned shall make a determination. And he was clearly assigned because he entered appearance as the presiding legal officer on the case during the hearing. So he was assigned to the proceeding and he did not. So he violated this language that he shall make a determination on. And he did not do that.
In the time that you have remaining, could you just assume with me that we do not agree with you that the statutes require that the same board member decide the case or issue the decision as conducted a hearing? Just assume with me, and that there's no regulation that directs the outcome. At that point, you can only prevail if there's some other doctrine. And that was what our pre-prepared discuss order was focused on, which was fair process. So if you could explain to me then your view about why, I'm assuming your position is that fair process itself requires the same person to render the decision as presided at a hearing.
Thank you, Your Honor. I looked at Smith versus Wilkie and the holding, because the holding in Smith versus Wilkie says the court holds that the principle of fair process require the board to provide claimants notice and an opportunity to respond when it purports to reverse prior assertions that evidence is credible or otherwise satisfactory to determine or to reverse prior assertions that evidence is credible or otherwise satisfactory to establish a fact necessarily to the claim, or when the board's order would leave the impression that it had determined the evidence was credible. The reason I switched to Smith is because the holding is about fair process. The facts are different, but what it says is when when the board changes its position in a way that's material to the outcome of the case, fair process doctrine said that the veteran should have notice and an opportunity to respond.
And so, Mr. Brown, I'm with you. I sat on Smith as well. I was one of the judges on that panel. If the board member who had conducted the hearing had said to Mr. Francis at the end of the hearing, thank you so much for appearing today. We appreciate your service to the nation. I've understood everything you've told me. And based on your demeanor today at this hearing, I find you credible. And then later, a different judge, a different board member, issues the decision that finds him not credible. That would raise Smith. Indeed, even if it was the same board member, that would raise Smith, right? Because it's about credibility. But your argument seems to be, writ large, under all circumstances, the fair process doctrine requires the same board member who presides at a hearing to always render the decision, right? Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think
so then help me, because in this case, I don't even read the final board decision that we are reviewing as making an adverse credibility finding. It weighs the evidence. It doesn't discount the evidence at the hearing. And if it did, maybe we would be faced with a different scenario. But you have to help me understand why fair process would require, in a situation in which no evidence is rejected as incredible and nothing happens at the hearing to lull the person into thinking that the same person's going to decide the case for some reason, why fair process would require that there always be the same board member.
Your Honor, I look to the body of the Arneson decision. And in Arneson, the fair process was discussed in essentially that exact situation, that it's the individual who makes the decision has the opportunity to see and hear the veteran or the witness and can assign credibility determinations from that testimony is very important. And so Arneson goes through and speaks about that quite a lot. The secretary made an argument in Arneson under Del Rosario versus Peak, and it looked to me like the court rejected that. And I'm just reading from, it says, okay, that in Arneson versus Brown, one judge is enough for a hearing, but a three-judge panel can decide. It's not controlling in the case. Okay, so we follow the statute as written, and then they talk about Chevron. But in Arneson, assessment of credibility and statements was the board's function, and they cite to Jones versus Derwinski and Smith versus Derwinski. And the court has to defer to the board on these issues because it's the board that gets to make these credibility determinations firsthand from the witness.
Yes, but you, and Don, you can put on 2 minutes just so we can finish this, but you keep talking about credibility, but there's no issue of credibility here, is there? Meaning nobody found your client or anything about anybody who testified at the hearing about credibility.
Well, that goes, Your Honor, that goes back to my fact issue, in that there's testimony in the record about the prostrating nature of headaches going back to 2009. And then it's just discounted. It's not even really explained.
No, I'm talking about the hearing, right? Your client gave testimony at a hearing, right?
Yes.
I can't remember whether his wife gave testimony as well, but this is focused on Mr. Francis. The board member who rendered the decision did not say that testimony was incredible, right? It just weighed it. And maybe it weighed it wrong, but that's something separate from saying there's an error because the person who actually sat in the hearing wasn't the person who wrote the decision.
I think that was the entire point of the fair process discussion in the Arneson decision, was that it still falls on the fact that the person who wrote it, who writes it, should be a person who got to see the witness for themselves.
And you know what? I'm with you in the sense that if I were sitting in Congress, I might have said, I don't want to take out what's in 7107 for precisely that reason. But if we say to Congress, you took it out in 7107, but we're going to use this nebulous concept of fair process to say, but you can't change it. That's what I was trying to get you to help with. So Judge Falvey, do you have any questions for Mr. Brown?
I just have a quick one. If we were to agree with you and we send this back to the board, and I guess in other instances as well, whenever there's a judge retires after a hearing or, God forbid, dies or takes a new position within the government, leaves government service, or post-hearing, but before the final report is issued, VA would have to give another hearing? Is that what you would?
Your Honor, under the legacy system, and I've practiced under it for about 11 years, under the legacy system, that was what happened. We just were given notice and an opportunity to respond. And we could check the box and ask for a hearing, or we could just ask for it to move forward with the new judge.
Okay.
But it was the veteran's option.
So if we send this back now, we adopt this for the AMA cases, and we send this back, it's got to be before the same judge that held the hearing or a new hearing?
No, Your Honor. It's just notice to the veteran with opportunity to respond. And if the veteran asks for a new hearing, then the hearing will be held. But if the veteran doesn't ask for the
hearing will be before the VLJ who heard the case previously, or it would be a new?
Your Honor, would have to, the way it worked under the legacy system was.
Now, I want to know how it's supposed to work under the AMA. If we send this back, and I assume there has to be a new hearing, or the VLJ who heard the case originally has to render a decision.
And Don, you could add 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The way I would look at it would be that we would get a remand letter, the remand letter would ask us whether we want a new hearing or whether.
Thank you.
Judge Jaquith, do you have anything?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. We'll give you your full rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bowker, you can begin, and we had a lot of extra time, so you can just take the time you need.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, the secretary asserts that the court should affirm the board's decision. The court should not find that Section 7102 governs, because that would make the previous provisions under Section 7107C superfluous, and it would also make Congress's decision to revise that statute a meaningless exercise in legislation. The previous section specifically stated what appellant is asking for, which is that the board member who conducts the hearing also will make the decision. And Congress removed that requirement. And so the secretary's view is that removed the requirement on VA to continue to do that. Section 7102 does not contain language regarding hearings. So the secretary disagrees with the appellant that the plain language of 7102 governs. The secretary also thinks that if the court finds that the provisions are ambiguous.
Mr. Bowker, where does 7102 fall short? Why doesn't the plain meaning of the words say what Mr. Brown says it does?
Your Honor, because the word proceeding is not defined in the statute, and
but a hearing is a proceeding, isn't it?
It can be part of a proceeding, Your Honor, but if it would render 7107C, the previous version, completely superfluous.
But that's a separate question. I want you to focus on the language of 7102. And hearing the proceeding, a board decision is a determination, isn't it?
A board decision is a determination, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So if you look at the definitions in Black's Law Dictionary, isn't the very essence of a hearing a proceeding that affords the veteran an opportunity to present information to the person who's going to make the determination?
I don't have that definition in front of me, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't believe it was in appellant's brief.
Well, Congress could have expressly stated what VA infers, couldn't it?
The Secretary's view is that the action Congress took when removing the requirement is a clear action that's akin to expressly stating it.
On that point, is there anything in the legislative history that shows that Congress, in passing the AMA, expressly considered the question of whether the same board member who conducts the hearing must or need not render decision?
Your Honor, the Senate and House committee reports are silent on that issue. They don't explicitly discuss that. But
it's not in the Senate testimony or the House testimony of the VA representatives, is it?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, no.
And is there anything in or about Section 7102 that shows that Congress understands the words "a member assigned a proceeding shall make a determination thereon" to permit a different member to be substituted to make that determination?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. Is there anything in 7102 or about 7102 that shows that Congress understands or has ever understood the words "a member assigned a proceeding shall make a determination thereon" to permit a different member to be substituted to make that determination?
I think you would have to read 7102 in conjunction with Section 7107 because they were promulgated at the same time when Congress removed the hearing provisions from 7102 and created the separate provisions in 7107. And because Congress used the two different languages, the Secretary's view is that it meant different things when it did that.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that Congress employed a belt and suspenders approach, would it?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, Your Honor.
Well, I guess it's an old reference by an old man, but it means ensuring that you hold your pants up by doing both things, even though one will do, wearing a belt and wearing suspenders.
The Secretary's view is that because Congress was being more specific in the Section 7107C, it knew how to write these requirements in, and that when it removed the requirements, it was doing a specific act and not something that was a meaningless act. To assume otherwise, the Secretary's view would be to assume that the Congress was injecting some sort of ambiguity into the statutory scheme.
Ah, and that's where the pro-veteran canon comes in, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the in Sears v. Principi, the Federal Circuit said that that you don't always go straight to the pro-veteran canon if there's a fair regulation on it. Does it have to be the outcome that the veteran wants in every single case? It's whether the regulations are consistent with the statutory scheme.
Yeah, but we're talking about a statute here. In what you're talking to Judge Jakewood about, and I'm not cutting Judge Jakewood off, but I'd like you to weave into your answer. You seem to agree that Congress didn't say anything about from which we can tell what proceeding means. But could you please address the first sentence of 7102 when it says "a proceeding instituted before the board"? Does that help us at all to understand what a proceeding is?
I don't know that helps us understand exactly what is.
Well, let me just throw this out there for you. I'm Not all questions are harmful, Mr. Boker, okay? If proceeding means hearing, that my position is that sentence seems weird to me, because that would say a hearing instituted before the board, right? We'd never say that, right? We'd say, you know, the appeal went before the board, the proceeding. That seems to me, the first sentence of 7102 provides some context for what proceeding is. If the secretary disagrees with that and say it doesn't, then that's okay. But it does seem to me that that provides some context to the fact that a proceeding seems to be something that is filed, it's instituted before the board. And I just wanted your reaction to that.
Well, Your Honor, the statutes refer to docketing as well. So I don't think that the proceeding necessarily means as soon as it goes to the board, the proceeding has begun. But in the secretary's regulations, 20.106, it discusses assigning proceedings, and that appears to be assigning it out for a decision. And the section 7102 also discusses decisions.
So, but okay, so I think I have your answer. But just so you know, that answer then tees up Judge Jakewith's question, which I think he's going to follow up now, which is Brown versus Gardner. Because if you say, oh, well, to understand this, I have to go to a regulation, that's precisely the issue that the Federal Circuit is split about, which is where in the order of operations Brown versus Gardner comes in with respect to Chevron. So I gave you the opportunity to tell me that we didn't need to do that because of 7102. I understand you didn't take it. But now I think I'm going to turn it back to Judge Jakewith because I think I know where he's going to go.
Well, yes, thanks, Judge Allen. I think the question is on the table, or if not, I'll ask it again. Doesn't the pro-veteran canon require that 7102, as we've discussed it, be construed in favor of the veteran's right to a hearing before the decision maker?
No, Your Honor. I think Sears v. Principi is still valid law. It says that Brown v. Gardner does not do away with Chevron deference. And in this case, the secretary believes that his regulations govern, if assuming that the court finds that the statutes are ambiguous.
Okay, thanks. Let's talk about the regulations. You wanted to do that. Let's do that. The new regulation 2706 says only that hearings will be conducted by a member or panel of members of the board. Nothing about whether the board member who conducts that hearing must or need not decide the case, right?
That's correct.
And it cites both 7102 and 7107 as authority, doesn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
And if VA intended for this regulation to operate the way it operated in this case, why wasn't VA more explicit about that? Why didn't they say so?
I can't answer why VA was not more explicit, but the VA was explicit for when it moved the legacy regulation to what is the section 20.604. So it does contain that specific requirement, and the secretary's view is by moving that requirement to 20.604, then the secretary was differentiating the two procedures.
Well, that's right. It says that in 604, but what VA said when they did that was VA proposes to add new section 20.706 to differentiate, your words were, the procedures for appeals in the new system, similar to proposed section 20.604 applicable to legacy appeals. This differentiate similar thing is oddly uninformative, isn't it?
Well, when it said it was redesignating 20.707, it does say it's trying to differentiate the two procedures, Your Honor.
Differentiate the similar procedures. Was VA hiding the ball here?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
Well, when it promulgated the new rules, that's when they proposed the new rules. And when they promulgated the new rules, they say nothing about it. Isn't that right?
Nothing specifically. The preamble to the new rules state that the rules were necessary to comport with the AMA. But no, there was apparently no comments on this rule.
But so the AMA says nothing about it either, right?
Well, the AMA has a statutory change, so that is a historical context governing the rules.
And what VA did say when they promulgated the new rules indicated they were all in on personal hearings before decision makers, right?
I don't recall that being in the Federal Register.
It was. Here it is. I'll give it to you and then ask you about it again. It was proposed by a commenter that VA accept recordings in lieu of formal hearings. And because it's more efficient. And VA said, no, we're not doing that because the efficiency gained was, and this is a quote, greatly outweighed by the benefits of an in-person hearing, the purpose of which is to elicit relevant and material testimony, assess the credibility of witnesses, resolve disputed issues of fact, and pose follow-up questions to witnesses and representatives. How is that consonant with sacrificing those benefits so you can substitute a different VLJ?
I think that goes to the content of the hearing, Your Honor, not who is going to decide the appeal after the hearing has happened.
Did VA promulgate a standard for when it deems substitution of a VLJ permissible or appropriate, such as Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 63's inability to proceed?
No, there's no statute. I mean, sorry, no regulation.
Is convenience enough?
The board has a computer system that assigns the cases to the. It's programmed to assign the cases to the VLJ who heard the hearing if they're available. If they're not available within 30 days of when the docket assignment is reached for the particular appeal, then it will assign it to any VLJ because this is consistent with the AMA's provisions of trying to make the process more efficient.
So it's expedience then?
Because that's consistent with the AMA, Your Honor. The AMA was designed.
But the AMA's basis is built on choice. And to Mr. Brown's point, there was no notice or an opportunity to weigh in on this change in this case, was there?
No, there was not. And the Secretary's view is that that was not required because the requirements for such to maintain the same VLJ have been removed from the statute and regulation. That was a choice that Congress made, and Appellant is asking the court to override Congress's will on this issue.
But apparently unknowingly, based on our conversation, at least there's no evidence that they knew that they were making that choice.
So there's no evidence the other way either. The best evidence would be that Congress removed the language, and that would show that Congress was intending to remove that requirement.
With or without a standard, why doesn't the practice include giving the veteran an opportunity to request a new hearing as section 20.715 gives veterans when hearing tapes or transcripts are lost, and Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 63 does for material witnesses in civil hearings?
Well, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are applicable to hearings before the board, but whether VA has implemented that requirement is a policy choice that was delegated to VA by Congress when they didn't specify whether or not to retain these requirements. So whether maybe someone would prefer those procedures doesn't necessarily mean that they're required under the current statutory and legislative regulatory scheme.
And there's nothing in the record of proceedings about whether it was necessary to have a different board member decide this case, is there?
No, Your Honor. There wouldn't have been because it was not argued below, and it wouldn't have been argued below because, he wouldn't have known in advance. But there is a if he thought there was a procedural problem, he had the opportunity to file a motion to vacate 38 CFR section 20.1000, which allows people to explain that they think VA has committed a procedural due process violation, and he did not avail himself of that opportunity. So there is an opportunity for him to be heard on whether he thinks this was a procedural error before VA, but that did not occur.
But there was no notice, right? There was nothing from VA informing the veteran that his choice of the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program meant he might have a different board member conduct the hearing and decide the case, right?
No, there's the notice of when he signed to opt into the RAMP program states that he was choosing new procedures. It does not, it references the AMA, but it doesn't.
There's nothing about what those procedures include, does
no,
it?
No, Your Honor, but the court has held that that people are charged with knowing the statutes and regulations when they're dealing with the government.
Well, and the RAMP review rights form specifically says the veteran can appeal to the board for consideration by a veterans law judge. Isn't that what it says? It's in the record at 94.
Yes, but it was considered by a veterans law judge, Your Honor. The secretary believes that the consideration is different from the hearing itself.
And here, the board member who conducted the May 2019 hearing indicated to the veteran and his wife that he, veterans law judge Reinhardt, that's who conducted the hearing, would be deciding the veteran's case by generally referring to himself in the first person, didn't he? Like, this issue will not be before me, and anything you tell me about how your current headaches are is not going to make any difference because I can't look at that. And if it's a VA doctor, I'll have all the records.
No, I disagree with that reading of that hearing, Your Honor. I think the judge was completely silent on whether he was going to decide the appeal. And if you look at the other hearing, I don't have the exact record site, but it's in the ROP, from his board hearing before he opted into RAMP, it is the judge repeatedly discusses how he is going to be the one deciding the case. So it's a completely different set of language that Judge Reinhardt used when he conducted the hearing in his RAMP or his AMA appeal.
Well, especially in light of the July 2013 hearing, wouldn't that be a fair reading of the outcome of the May 2019 hearing, the language that the Veterans Law Judge Reinhardt used? He didn't suggest that it might be decided by someone else.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's a fair reading. Mr. Francis opted into a procedures, even if he wasn't described all the procedures, he opted into to the AMA, and the opt-in specifically said there were different procedures. He could have remained on the legacy and had a hearing in front of the same judge who decided his appeal. It would have been required by law. But he opted into the AMA, which is in a more efficient set of procedures, and he probably got a board decision sooner because of that.
I'll let that one sit for now. But how about VA's public descriptions of the process for veterans? Don't they still indicate that the same board member who hears their case will decide it?
I'm not aware of any that state that. The appellant certainly didn't plead that in his briefs.
Well, they're out there in the public saying in the How Do I Appeal booklet, the veterans law judge does not make a decision at the hearing. After the hearing, a transcript of the hearing is created and associated with your file and will be reviewed by the Veterans Law Judge together with all other evidence in deciding your appeal. And if that's too dated, how about VA's blog, How to Get a Virtual Hearing at the BVA, which says the veteran, their representative, and the judge all meet to discuss the veteran's appeal. The judge is there to help, asking the veteran questions to better understand the appeal. After the hearing, the appeal is held for about 90 days or more before the judge reviews the appeal and issues a decision. Isn't that misleading?
I'd have to read that, but I don't believe that that's misleading, Your Honor. No.
Well, let's finally turn to the subject of our Be Prepared to Discuss order, fair process. In light of the long line of our precedential decisions from Fuller 50 days ago through Bryant and Smith in 2020 and back to Thurber in 1993, isn't it by now well settled that the veteran has a right to fair process in the development and adjudication of their claims and appeals, and the board is obligated to ensure that veterans get that fair process?
Secretary doesn't dispute that veterans have a right to fair process, but if you look at Smith, and it's quoting from Thurber, and I think this sort of line of quotations is throughout the court's precedents on this, discusses fair process as being an additional process that's implicit in the VA adjudicatory process system. Now the language about that, the Secretary's view is if the Congress has removed a process from VA's system, it can't be said to be implicit in the system. This would be more a Vermont Yankee situation where the court would be prohibited of imposing additional processes on VA when Congress is.
But what you're contending here is that for cases under the AMA, the statutes and regulations don't prescribe any particular process regarding a board member who conducts a veterans hearing also being required to decide the veterans case, right? That's what you're saying. It's permitted because it's not prohibited. So there's no particular process prescribed, right?
The process prescribed is that the person who is for AMA, there's no requirement. Yes, that's what
you infer permission, but there's nothing, no process prescribed. As Judge Allen said, they're not all trick questions.
No, there is for panels, but not for single judge BVA decisions.
And that's exactly when Smith said fair process kicks in, even in situations where no particular procedural process is required, right?
It infers permission, but in this case, we think that you can't infer permission or infer a process when it's not in there when that has been removed. It'd be one thing if it was never mentioned previously in the statutes or regulations, but when Congress has a procedure that was required and then it's been removed, our view is that the court would be prohibited from adding that back in the name of under the fair process doctrine. That would be inconsistent with the statutes and regulations.
And so is it the Secretary's position that the court then can't consider whether fairness requires a particular process in light of the underlying concepts that imbue our system, basic fair play and pro-veteran, non-adversarial, duty to assist, duty to maximize benefits, all those things?
In this particular case, Your Honor, the Secretary's view is Congress acted, and because Congress acted, that the court would be prohibited from adding additional processes. It would be one thing.
Does the veteran's right to fair process include the right to a personal hearing before his decision maker?
No, Your Honor.
Do you
have an answer? Be I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to follow up. I just want to make sure the secretary is really taking what appears to be a binary position, meaning that the answer is, according to what you're saying to Judge Jaquith, there is no situation in which a fair process principle could, under this circumstance, require the same decision maker?
Oh, let me clarify. Your hypothetical that you gave when you were questioning appellant's counsel, I think would probably be a fair process violation. I'm speaking under the facts of this case, and as a general matter, whether the court should impose the procedures that appellant has requested.
Thanks for clearing that up. I was surprised that the secretary was taking what I understood. Thank you for clearing it up. Sorry, Judge Jaquith.
I'm sorry, Judge Jaquith, if I could also, I recognize we asked you all to be prepared to discuss about fair process and everything, but hasn't the appellant waived this argument or abandoned this argument by not raising it in their opening briefs or even in their reply brief?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. I think we put in our brief that he had waived all arguments not raised in his brief. I certainly don't think he's met his burden of establishing that the fair process was violated on the facts of his specific situation here. He opted into AMA, so he gave up the procedures that he's now seeking. And under the court's case law, the board didn't make a credibility finding, so he's presumed to be credible. What the board did was weigh the evidence in this appeal and found it was.
Some questions about that, but I want to follow up first on your answer to the Arneson question that, at least as a general matter, fair process does not include the right to a personal hearing before the decision maker. That's your view.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I want to ask you how that can be squared with Arneson, because Arneson's holding is not, with all due respect to my colleague's apparent different view of the case, is not limited to statutory analysis. It goes on to decide that the reason why the statutory violation is prejudicial is its specific finding that the assignment of a replacement board member to decide the veteran's appeal without providing an opportunity for a hearing in front of the decision maker, and this part is a quote, deprived the veteran of an opportunity to meaningfully participate in the processing of his claim in a way that could have altered the board's credibility determination, and that necessitated remand so he could have that hearing. Isn't that right?
That was in the context of prejudicial error analysis when the court had already decided that Mr. Arneson had a right. So the secretary's view is the prejudicial error analysis, even though it uses terms such as fairness, is a different type of analysis than to whether to impose an extra statutory or regulatory right beyond what the statute or regulation is required.
Well, in conducting hearings and deciding veterans' cases, the board functions as a fact finder in a manner similar to a trial court. Isn't that right?
Dawn, you can put down 5 minutes so we can finish this.
Yes, Your Honor. The board does find facts, and to the extent that the court in Arneson discussed being able to view a witness's demeanor as being something that helps assess credibility, that doesn't mean that just because there's a better way to assess credibility than that is the way that's required. So the secretary's view is that Congress did require it. It made changes to create a more efficient system. It still left some procedural protections in place, but it did remove that one.
But it didn't leave much fair process. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. We believe that there is fair process. We just believe that just because there may be a better way to determine credibility, Congress made a choice there. I mean,
isn't the board hearing uniquely important because it's the veteran's opportunity to personally interact with the board member who will find the facts and make the credibility determination and render the final decision on his claim. And it gives the board member an opportunity to size the veteran up, to assess the veteran's demeanor, facial expressions, eye contact, voice, tone, volume and inflection, gestures, hesitation or readiness to answer questions, all the nonverbal cues that help a listener decide whether a speaker is credible. That's the critical importance of the personal hearing before the decision maker, isn't it?
Well, I believe the statutes and regulations don't actually say that. They don't outline those things as being the reason for the hearing. I mean, it is an opportunity for the veteran to submit oral testimony, but the secretary's view is that it's not required that the person who conducts it also decide the appeal.
Well, what about our court's view that having a member, as expressed in Arneson, that having a board member assess credibility based on a review of a transcript, again, a quote, undermines the veteran's ability to personally impress his credibility upon his fact finders?
I'd reiterate that I have 2 points on that. First is that was during, the court had already found it right, and that was in a prejudicial error analysis. But second, in Arneson v. Brown, which the court discussed in Arneson v. Shinseki, the appellant did raise a fair process argument and said the entire VBA panel should have been present at the hearing rather than just one board member. And the court in that case didn't find that was a fair process violation. It found that because the statute didn't require it, that process wasn't required. And we think the same is true here. And the court in Arneson v. Shinseki said that the Arneson v. Brown case was correctly decided. So even though the court did find prejudicial error in Arneson v. Shinseki, we don't think that mandates a fair process requirement beyond what the statutes and regulations require.
Let's turn to talking about that question in the context of the facts of this case. Didn't Veterans Law Judge Reinhart, the board member who conducted the hearing, ask the veteran and his wife specific questions that they answered under oath regarding the frequency and severity of the veteran's headaches, all of which was on the record and reflected in a verbatim transcript?
Yes.
And doesn't that process distinguish the hearing testimony from treatment records and examination reports that do not include such recorded verbatim questions and sworn answers?
Could you repeat the question? I'm not sure.
Doesn't the hearing process with recorded verbatim questions and sworn answers, isn't that distinct from treatment records and examination reports that have nothing of the sort? It's not a trick question.
Well, it's distinct, Your Honor, but I think what the board relied on when it weighed the evidence was the contemporaneousness, not the distinctness.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second. Stay with me here. But since the pivot point here seemed to be the period of time the veteran suffered prostrating headaches and the frequency of those experiences, wasn't it significant that the VLJ discussed those issues with the veteran and his wife and even described what prostrating meant?
Well, the Veterans Law Judge is not able to cross-examine the witness, so I'm not exactly sure what you mean. The veteran did describe his hearing, his symptoms, that he had dizziness, I believe, and he had to lie down sometimes. But he didn't describe the words that the board defined prostrating as, needing to being utterly powerlessness, I believe, and helpless or something.
Well, let's talk about what the board member did do, the hearing board member.
John, you can add 5 more minutes, please. Thank you.
Didn't Judge Reinhart's interaction with the veteran and his wife put him in position to assess their credibility and judge whether any inconsistencies with treatment and examination records were minor, innocent variances, or indicators of unreliability?
I don't think that is credibility doesn't mean that they were not being truthful or that they were not sincere in their statements. As the Supreme Court said in the Garland versus Ming Dai case from last year, that just because you're credible doesn't mean that you can't have your evidence weighed against other evidence of record. So I don't think that this issue turned on whether Judge Reinhardt or the judge who decided the appeal determined that they were not credible in what they were reporting as their symptoms.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second. But since Judge Reinhardt concluded the hearing by saying, I want to thank you for your help in the memory issues, thanking the veteran and his wife for their testimony, and then specifically saying to the wife, I want to thank you for your help in the memory issues and everything like that. You were very helpful. Wouldn't a reasonable person told that they were very helpful in getting through memory issues have the impression that the board had considered their testimony credible?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, apparently Veterans Law Judge Catino agrees with you because she decided otherwise, didn't she? She acknowledged that the veteran and his wife testified that the veteran had severe prostrating headaches during the contested period, but nonetheless, and immediately said, the evidence does not show that his headaches were productive of prostrating attacks.
I think that's a weighing of the evidence, Your Honor. It's not a finding that Mr. and Mrs. Francis were not credible.
Well, it's saying, you say this, I find the exact opposite. That's a little more than just weighing the evidence.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
But all right, well, let's talk about her basis for that determination. So she never met, spoke with, or heard from the veteran and his wife, right?
That's correct.
And relied on treatment records and an examination report, right? That's what you said.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's not much in those records and report, is there?
It describes him as not having prostrating headaches, and the treatment records do describe some of the frequency and severity of his headaches prior to the November 2014 exam where he had more severe headaches.
Well, to get down to brass tacks, on the topic of prostrating attacks, the April 2014 examination report is just a check yes or no, and the examiner puts an X next to no, right? There's no explanation, no discussion, no rationale to tell the board or us the basis for that X. Isn't that so?
You're right. The examiner discussed from my reading of the report, the examiner obtained that information from appellant about his headaches and then used her expertise to mark the box saying that they were not prostrating attacks.
Well, that may be your interpretation of the report, but it says nothing like that. It says almost nothing, really. It does say that the veteran had sudden onset of painful headaches 3 times a month with light sensitivity, and it incorrectly noted that his headache condition had been diagnosed in 2014, that same year. And that's it. That's all the substance to the report. And then there's the X, not prostrating. There's nothing to indicate that she discussed that with him or how she arrived at that X, is there?
Well, the narrative that you cite, Your Honor,
it's at R2619 if you want to look at it.
I have it in front of me, Your Honor. The narrative that you cite described the history, indicates that she took the veteran's history and he described his symptoms to her. So I don't know. If she said they're not prostrating, I don't know what else she was supposed to do there.
Maybe some analysis, rationale, explanation of the sort that normally is required to rely on a medical examination report?
I mean, I would say appellant has waived the adequacy of the examination report. I don't even think he discussed it in his presentation today. But
well, let's talk about the other medical reports in the record for the relevant period. There's really just 3, aren't there?
I believe so.
There's the February 2010 nurse's note that says the veteran was having headaches that caused blurred vision 4 or 5 times a day, right?
Yes.
And then there's a neurology consultation note from March 2013 that also doesn't specifically address prostration, but says that the veteran had experienced headaches since he got knocked out in the Army with pressure pain like a vice grip that may radiate throughout the day and are acute, or is acute, excuse me, several times a day, or if medicated, several times each week, with pain as severe as 10 out of 10. So that's at 2435 for the record, right?
Yes.
And then there's a disability benefits questionnaire a doctor completed in November 2014 describing similar symptoms and concluding that the veteran had very frequent prostrating attacks of migraine headaches, right?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the date? Is that the November 2014?
November 2014.
Right? Yes, yes, Your Honor.
And then there's the July 2013 testimony you referred to, that he was experiencing sudden, very sharp headache pain that doubled him over multiple times a week, sometimes several times a day, right?
Yes.
So based on the April 2014 X and the reports we've talked about, the deciding VLJ, without talking to the veteran or his wife at all, rejected their testimony because she didn't see that rejected the testimony she didn't see or hear, right?
Well, she found it less probative than the other evidence.
Judge Jacob, do you have anything else for Mr. Broker?
Just a couple things, Your Honor.
Can you put on 2 more minutes?
Isn't it a maxim that what is expedient often is not what's right?
Is expedience often at odds with what's right? It can be, Your Honor, but in this, the Secretary believes the statutes and regulations for the AMA don't sacrifice rightness for expedience purposes. There was a tremendous backlog of cases with the legacy system, and all parties involved were working to improve the system to create one that's fair to veterans because they don't have to wait as long. And it may have less procedures, but the procedures are what oftentimes cause what they refer to as churn in the reports and in the case law and in the preamble to the regulations here.
Well, does the Secretary really want the AMA, his rulemaking, or this court to eliminate the veteran's right to a personal hearing before her or his decision maker because it's inconvenient or it takes a little more time?
Secretary believes it's not required, and the Secretary is not arguing that it's inconvenient, but it will cause delay to impose that requirement.
Why should we upend Arneson and other cases that have relied on it, like Cook, that there are specifically grounded in a veteran's right to a personal hearing before the board decision maker as a right fundamental to fair and meaningful proceedings? Why should we upend that?
Arneson was not based on fair process. It was based on the statutes and regulations. So the Secretary doesn't believe it will upend Arneson at all to reach that holding.
Nothing more for me, Judge Allen.
Judge Falvey?
No, nothing for me.
Thank you, Mr. Broker.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown, you have your 3 minutes. Would you please, in addition to what else you're going to say in those 3 minutes, please address Judge Falvey's point that you did not raise most of these issues in your opening brief.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll begin there. My brief was based on making a factual argument and a legal argument and a reasons and basis argument. So the issue, first of all, is that the Artisan case was addressed by the secretary in his brief, but was not addressed in my brief. And so it's before the court as it was raised by the secretary, and the court's order that invited me to be prepared to talk about Arneson and Smith. And based on the court's order inviting me to be ready to talk about those things, I prepared to be ready to talk about those things. And the main focus of my approach has been on the legal issue, as I was asked to talk about that first, is the fact that Section 7102 was not rewritten. And so I don't think taking words out of Section 7107 changes the fact that Congress decided to not change Section 7102. And during the Secretary's portion of today's argument, Judge Allen pointed out, and I've been reading from just the middle of the paragraph of the statute of 7102A, but the first sentence does say a proceeding instituted before the board may be assigned to an individual member of the board or to a panel of not less than three members of the board. Then it goes on to say a member or panel assigned to a proceeding shall make a determination thereon, including any motion filed in connection therewith. So reading those two sentences together, I go back to the argument I made when I was making my original argument, that statute still exists today, the same as it did before the implementation of the AMA. And in this case, it says that a proceeding instituted before the board may be assigned to an individual or to a panel. In this case, an individual was assigned. That individual held the hearing, but he did not do what the statute says, which is shall make a determination thereon. And so I just reiterate, that's been the thrust of my argument throughout this process. I also wanted to point out again that the procedural posture of this case is different than a pure AMA case in that opting into RAMP happened before the implementation of the AMA. And last of all, a proceeding instituted, is followed by. So I want to then talk about Brown versus Gardner.
If you can do that briefly, Mr. Brown, we've let both parties go on an exceedingly long time. So
yes, Your Honor.
You can try to wrap this up, please.
Then, Your Honor, I would just follow that up by saying Brown versus Gardner provides a pro-veteran approach when the court is looking at an issue like this. And I did want to say that I did also brief the issue of reasons and basis. And it is briefed in the opening brief that reasons and basis are implicated here, so that we should prevail under reasons and basis if we don't do it on pure fact or pure law, because of the fact that the judge acknowledged the testimony in the record and then abruptly said, I'm going to rule against you. And there isn't enough explanation for the parties to understand the outcome of the case. And I think that's Gilbert's standard. So I'll finish there, Your Honor.
Judge Falvey, do you have anything else?
I do not. Thank you very much.
Judge Jaquet.
No, thanks, Judge Allen.
Thanks to both parties, and we appreciate your flexibility in terms of our change of schedule due to matters beyond anybody's control. The court very much appreciates that, and With that, the matter is submitted for decision.
And the court is in recess.